World Service to the BBC, this is Oliver Scott with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, US aircraft take off from a Turkish base to bomb targets in northern Iraq, and Baghdad launches a diplomatic offensive to try to persuade Ankara to throw the Americans out.
Turkey is a neighbor, and we hope that neighbors should respect security and the national interest of each other.
Also today, Russia steps up the pressure at the Kosovo peace talks near Paris, but is the message from Moscow what the Western powers want to hear? And alternative medicine in India. It's widespread, but the most popular form is a European import. First, the news in detail. Here's Guy Francis.
BBC World Service. The largest political party in Nigeria, the People's Democratic Party, has declared its candidate for presidential elections in 2 weeks' time, the contest that will end more than 15 years of military rule. He's Olusegun Obasanjo, who was a military head of state in the late 1970s. As Barnaby Phillips reports from Lagos, General Obasanjo is the favourite to become Nigeria's next president.
General Obasanjo has won a crushing victory at the PDP convention in Jos, attracting over 65% of the votes. His supporters, who had stayed up all night to watch the voting, immediately began celebrating in the streets surrounding the convention stadium. His nearest rival, Dr. Alex Ekweme, trailed far behind with just over 20% of the votes. Supporters of these two men fought a long and bitter campaign. The PDP must now try and heal the rifts that have opened up within it. If the party can do this, General Obasanjo, once an authoritarian military ruler, will become Nigeria's first civilian president in over 15 years.
United States aircraft based in Turkey have again attacked Iraqi air defenses in northern Iraq. American officials said two F-15 jets had been fired on by anti-aircraft artillery near the city of Mosul. In response, a guided missile was fired at one of the sites. An Iraqi spokesman said five people were killed in the attack. It happened during talks between Turkish leaders and Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, who wants them to end cooperation with the Americans. Chris Morris reports from Ankara.
The US Air Force said military sites near the city of Mosul were attacked after they targeted American jets. The Iraqis said five people were killed and 22 were injured, including civilians, in a number of airstrikes in both the north and south of the country. But the Turkish government has made it clear that American and British planes will continue flying patrols over northern Iraq from a base on Turkish soil. Ankara has also urged Iraq to comply with all relevant UN resolutions on disarmament. But at the same time, it wants dialogue with the Iraqi authorities, and that upsets the United States. After holding talks with Turkish leaders, Tariq Aziz said there had been a good discussion of bilateral issues. The real problem, he said, was one of foreign interference.
The Russian Foreign Minister, Igor Ivanov, has held talks with the Serbian and ethnic Albanian delegations at the Kosovo peace talks at Rambouillet Castle near Paris. The delegations are discussing military aspects of the settlement in what international mediators hope will be a decisive second week of the talks. Mr. Ivanov said there had to be a political solution to the conflict, but said the international community would need to seek Belgrade's approval before deploying NATO troops in the troubled Serbian province. Ceremonies are being held throughout the former Soviet republics on the 10th anniversary of the withdrawal of the last Soviet troops from Afghanistan. The Russian Prime Minister, Yevgeny Primakov, laid a wreath at a ceremony in Moscow where war veterans are to march in memory of the 15,000 Soviet soldiers who died in the 10-year conflict with Western-backed Islamists. From Moscow, here's Paul Anderson.
In December 1979, tens of thousands of troops were, in the words of the Kremlin leadership, invited into Afghanistan to support the Marxist puppet government. But the policy of openness initiated by Mikhail Gorbachev showed the atrocities of the war for the first time to the Soviet people, spawning the country's first anti-war movement and, by most accounts, forcing an eventual withdrawal. The last commander to leave Afghan soil, Boris Gromov, said the war contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union. He added that Russia's military debacle in the southern Russian Republic of Chechnya 5 years later showed that the country's leaders had failed to learn the lessons of Afghanistan. Mr. Gorbachev echoed that today, saying President Yeltsin had failed to understand the limitations of military power.
A British judge and jury are travelling in Belarus today to visit the town of Domachevo, where thousands of Jews were killed during the Second World War. There, the British court will hear evidence in the case of Antony Savonyuk, who is charged with killing four Jews during the German occupation. He denies the charges. It's the first time a British court has met in a foreign country. Mr. Savonyuk once lived in Domachevo, but later moved to Britain and worked as a railway's ticket collector. Now, aged 76, he's refused to travel to the town. An Australian court has ordered the extradition of one of Italy's most wanted fugitives. The man, Giovanni Farina, is wanted in Italy on charges including kidnapping and attempted murder, which date back to the 1980s. He is accused of masterminding the kidnappings of wealthy business people. BBC World Service.
Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz made it plain enough what Baghdad wants, an end to Turkish help for the Americans and British in bombing Iraq.
I will raise the issue that a Turkish base is being used by the Americans and the British to attack Iraq. And this is unfortunate because Turkey is a neighbor, and we hope that neighbors should respect security and the national interest of each other.
But Mr. Aziz had barely set foot on Turkish soil than he'd been assured by Turkey's foreign minister, Ismail Cem, that the policy of US forces operating from Turkey's Incirlik base would not change. And whether specifically to press that point home or not, US aircraft today took off from Incirlik and attacked two Iraqi sites in the Northern Air Exclusion Zone. On the line now from the US European Command headquarters in Stuttgart in Germany is Captain Mike Blass. Captain, what can you tell us about these raids?
Well, today we had two separate incidents. The first one happened about 11:20 Iraqi time. Two F-15s were doing routine enforcement of the northern no-fly zone, and they were fired upon by an anti-aircraft artillery site north of Mosul. And in response to this hostile act, one of the F-15s dropped a GBU-12 laser-guided bomb onto the AAA site.
Now, Iraq is saying, we gather, that five people were killed in this raid. Do you have any information on that?
I have no information as to any damage to Iraqi forces or any injury to Iraqi personnel. All we can say, though, is that we do everything in our power to make sure that there is no collateral damage, that the only damage is to the targeted site that has been shooting at us or painting us with radar. If the Iraqis are putting their munitions in populated areas, then Saddam Hussein, and only Saddam Hussein, is to blame for any injuries.
What orders do these combat pilots have if fired upon? Do they have to report back to base and ask what to do next, so to speak, or do they then just go ahead and attack?
Now, if they are fired upon, they have the authority to defend themselves.
Which in this case is what they did?
That's correct.
And they returned home safely?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. There was no damage to coalition aircraft or any injury to coalition personnel.
Captain Blass at the command headquarters in Stuttgart, many thanks.
Thank you.
The relationship between Iraq and Turkey, of course, is finely balanced. Utterly opposed on the question of Turkey's close relations with the US, buttressed by NATO, utterly united on the need to keep Kurdish nationalist aspirations in check. Ankara surely would like to improve relations with Baghdad, but that might mean finding a new strategy to replace Washington's present form of making Iraq an international pariah. George Joffe from the Royal Institute of International Affairs is with me in the NewsHour studio. George Joffe, do you see in all this a joint desire, so to speak, between Baghdad and Ankara to repair past deep damage?
I think that desire has been around for quite some time. In fact, it goes back two or three years when the Turks tried to find common ground with Iraq to begin oil exports again through the pipeline that runs from Iraq into Turkey. And it's certainly true that the Turkish parliament has on occasion been very reluctant to renew the permission for Allied aircraft to use the Incirlik base. It has to be renewed every 6 months. And beyond that, too, Turkey has not been anxious to be implicated in formal attacks on Iraq of the kind that occurred at the end of last year. So, to that extent, the Turks and the Iraqis are seeking common ground. But at the same time, inside Turkey, the generals in particular are anxious to maintain Turkey's stance inside NATO. Turkey is a resolute ally of the United States in particular, and Turkey is a representative of Western interests and therefore determined to see the sanctions resolutions carried out.
So as American aircraft take off, and they did today from Incirlik, it's a pretty invidious position for Turkey to be in, isn't it? To square that point about Incirlik with a desire to improve relations with Baghdad on the other hand.
Well, that's absolutely true. And the Turks always find themselves in a very difficult situation from this point of view. There are other problems too. Iraq used to be a major trading partner for Turkey in the 1980s. That all vanished after 1990. There's also the issue of the Kurds in northern Iraq, and Turkish fears that, in fact, the Iraqis have allowed the PKK in particular to base themselves there on the grounds that they couldn't control their activities because of the Allied northern no-fly zone, and thereby to attack Turkey. So in a sense, therefore, there are also tensions between the two, and the Turks, as much as they support the Western initiatives over Iraq, at the same time wish that they could find a common ground with Iraq itself to deal with their own border problems.
Because the fear in Ankara is that if Iraq, by chance, by some huge misfortune, were to be divided, then that could form the basis of a Kurdistan, which Turkey wants to see least of all.
Well, it's not just the Turks that are worried about that, the Syrians too, and the Iranians. And in fact, the three countries have on several occasions made it clear that they support the territorial integrity of Iraq precisely because of their anxieties about the growth of an independent Kurdistan. They also view, by the way, the current American initiatives to support the PUK and the PKD, the two major Turkish Kurdish parties inside Iraq, with considerable suspicion because they fear this could be the beginning of an independent Kurdish state.
So on this issue, and it's a very important one, Baghdad and Ankara are like blood brothers.
Not quite. The Turks, in fact, make use of an agreement in 1984 for free entry into northern Iraq to control the PKK. And they also fear that if they join too closely with Iraq, they may find themselves in great difficulties with the West.
George Duffy, many thanks. With less than 6 days to go now to find an agreement over Kosovo, proceedings at the peace talks in Rambouillet Castle have arguably been made more complex still with the intervention of Russia's Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov. He's arrived, it seems, to make two points: that Belgrade must approve the deployment of any NATO troops in Kosovo, and that if the talks fail, NATO airstrikes must not follow. The BBC's Barnaby Mason is at Rambouillet. He joins us now. Barney, no surprise, presumably, in any of this from Moscow, but not a very welcome message either.
Well, I suppose that the Western countries won't be altogether glad to hear it restated, but generally speaking, they think it's the Russian standard position. And it's worth pointing out that NATO countries themselves don't actually want to put troops on the ground in Kosovo if there is no agreement and if there is fighting still going on. They're not proposing to fight their way in. They want a political deal which obviously means the agreement of both sides that they should go in. So when Mr. Ivanov says that the deployment of any international force has to be agreed with Belgrade, well, really he's just stating the obvious. Where the Russians really part company with the Western countries is on the question of if there is no deal, and the Serbs are blamed by the West. Russia, of course, would be deeply opposed to any use of airstrikes in order to make them agree.
All of which underlines a point which I guess is pretty well known already, that the contact group is not really solid on the way ahead.
I think it's quite a lot more solid than it has been at many times in the past. It's true that the Russians have not agreed on all the text of the military annex. That's the part of the proposed peace deal, which deals with these military questions, and not only, of course, the question of the deployment of an international force, but also the requirements that will be laid on the military forces of both sides to withdraw, to give up heavy weapons, and so on. Now, the Russians still have reservations about parts of that. Nevertheless, I think it's quite significant that the Russians are not preventing these parts of the agreement, these annexes, from going forward formally to the negotiators on both sides. And if, of course, Belgrade would agree to the deployment of a force, then I don't think the Russians would object. What is not quite clear is to what extent has Mr. Ivanov been saying to the Serbs, look, you will have to agree to this. If he's been doing that, of course, that's what the Western governments hope and rather count on the Russians to wield that sort of influence. It's not clear what he's been saying to the Serbs in private.
And just in a couple of sentences, Barney, 5.5 days to go now before the deadline on reaching the agreement. I imagine that some pretty ferocious arm twisting is the order of the day, is it?
I imagine it is. It's a very little amount of time to produce this very complex agreement. They haven't even got agreement on self-government so far, and all the military aspects still have to be dealt with. And we're going to see during the course of the week, at the moment planned for Wednesday, another intervention by the British and French co-chairmen, the two foreign ministers, and that will be symptomatic of the enormous pressure being put on the two sides to agree.
Barney Mason at the Kosovo Peace Talks, many thanks. And ahead now in the programme, why did the Soviets go into Afghanistan and what legacy did they leave behind? You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Oliver Scott. You're tuned to NewsHour. And the main news headlines, Nigeria's biggest political party has chosen a former military leader, Olusegun Obasanjo, as its presidential candidate. He's now a favourite to lead the country on its return to democratic government. And the Americans say their aircraft have attacked more targets in northern Iraq, the raids coinciding with Iraqi attempts to persuade Turkey to reduce its cooperation with Washington. And a time check, it's now approaching 13:17 GMT. It's 10 years since the last Soviet troops pulled out of Afghanistan. 1 million Afghanis died in the conflict, almost 15,000 Soviet soldiers. The war left other lasting scars too. Afghanistan is still a very troubled country, and the lies and deception which surrounded the Soviet Union's participation in it contributed to the country's collapse in 1991. Our Russian affairs analyst Stephen Diel looks back at what many consider was a great mistake made by the Soviet leadership.
When 80,000 Soviet troops entered Afghanistan in December 1979, the press was silent. Then it became an occasion to extol the glories of the mighty Soviet army. But for those who hadn't been to Afghanistan, such heroic tunes hid the ghastly reality of a bloody war. One nurse's account was published in a book called Zinky Boys, a title referring to the sealed zinc coffins in which the dead were returned to the Soviet Union.
A pile grew up behind the hospital, a pile of amputated arms, legs and other bits of our men, dead bodies with gouged out eyes, and stars carved into the skin of their backs and stomachs by the Mujahideen. Gradually we began to ask ourselves what we were all here for. Such questions were unpopular with the authorities, of course. There were no slippers or pyjamas, but plenty of banners and posters with political slogans, all brought from back home. Behind the slogans were our boys' skinny, miserable faces.
As part of the truth began to filter back to the Soviet Union, the government began to make provisions for Afghan veterans, Afghansi, to receive social benefits such as health care and flats. But the Afghansi were not the first in Russian history to find that the country is so big that the gulf between the theory of decisions taken at the highest level and the practice of how they are carried out on the ground can be vast. Yevgeny Khrushchev was an army officer who served in Afghanistan. He still remembers the reaction many Afghansi found on their return.
Knee-jerk reaction was, hey guys, we didn't send you there. This is what they use as an excuse to block all our efforts to resolve all types of problems that came up back from Afghanistan. Psychological, medical problems, disability problems, housing, these sort of things.
But there was a positive reaction too. When it became clear to many veterans that no one was going to help them despite the lofty promises of the government, they took matters into their own hands. Yevgeny Khrushchev.
What helped us a great deal was our understanding that only us can help ourselves in a new political and business environment. So our guys, when they started to consider all the situation in Russia like a political and economic guerrilla warfare, and most of them handle it very successfully. Just to name a few generals, Rutskoy, Lebedev, ex-minister Gorbachev, and the most prominent among Afghan veterans, generals, General Bardyuzha, who right now is in charge of the Russian president administration.
But the Afghan war had wider repercussions too, both for the Soviet army and for the Soviet Union itself. Charles Dick is head of the Conflict Studies Research Centre at the British Army's Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst. He's watched the Russian army fall into disarray in the last few years. And one of the reasons is that it didn't learn the lessons of the Afghan war.
As far as the army as a whole is concerned, I think they're really much more interested in drawing a veil over the thing than trying to learn real lessons from it. Afghanistan is the sort of experience that the Russian army would like to forget.
And Yevgeny Khrushchev believes that even 10 years after the Soviet Union extricated itself from the Afghan war, the full effects that it had on society have not yet been appreciated.
Most people, even most political analysts, don't understand the ramifications of Afghan warfare to the consciousness of the Russian people under the communist regime. First time people realized that they were doing something which they were utterly disagreed, and they decided to speak out loud.
By the time the Soviet army withdrew from Afghanistan, gone were the days of pretending that all was well with Soviet society and the heroic Soviet army. And less than 3 years later, the USSR would be gone too.
Stephen Diel reporting there. And since the Soviets left, the fortunes of Afghanistan have veered in a number of directions before finding stability of a kind with the rule of the Taliban militia in most of the country. Most, but not all. Ahmed Wali Massoud is the Afghan representative here in London for the ousted government of President Rabbani, and he's the brother of Ahmed Shah Massoud, the man still fighting the Taliban in the hills. He blames the international community for leaving Afghanistan at the mercy of its neighbours, and he blames Pakistan's support of the Taliban as the main obstacle to peace.
For 10 years, the Afghan nation fought against the invading force of the Russians. And that in itself was, that the struggle was held and assisted and did have the sympathy of worldwide, especially the Western countries and the Arab countries. But since the Russian gone from Afghanistan, that sympathy or that cooperation was all gone with it. These countries, especially the United States and the Western world, which should not have left Afghanistan on its own, should have helped and aided Afghanistan to do its own reconstruction after all of the suffering. They left Afghanistan to the mercy of its neighbors, especially Pakistan. And since then, Pakistan started its own program of intervention, and eventually, after 10 years now, since the Soviet Union troops have left Afghanistan, we are still at the same suffering, and the suffering of Afghan people is not over. And it's due to the Pakistan's direct involvement inside Afghanistan.
Ahmed Wali Massoud there, and of course a complex history indeed. But what of daily life in a country where instability of one sort or another seems almost endemic? William Reeve is a Kabul resident. He's our correspondent there. William, peaceful now at any rate, Kabul?
Yes, it is. And people are very grateful for the peace that there is in Kabul at the moment. I've certainly been here at extremely unpeaceful times when, you know, rockets have rained down on the city from both sides of the fighting at the time and seen dozens of people being sort of killed and injured every day. And although many ordinary citizens don't like having to wear beards in the case of men, or in the case of educated women wear burqas, people are very grateful that the Taliban have disarmed the the country. It's the one service they really have given, according to the residents of Kabul especially.
Now, William, you were also there when the Soviets started withdrawing, what, 10 and more years ago. What sort of legacy at that time did they leave behind them?
Well, I remember seeing that the first regiment that was leaving Afghanistan, it was also the first regiment that arrived in Afghanistan, and I went up to it, I remember going up to a tank and seeing these young Russian soldiers, and actually it was very politically incorrect for a Western correspondent at the time, feeling extremely sorry for them, and I spoke to them over the course of about 2 hours and listened to their experiences in Afghanistan, and this particular small group in this tank had been on one hill for about, getting on for 3 years, just sitting there, being attacked and what have you. And it was difficult for them, it was difficult for Afghans. It was just a very sorry period of history.
So to bridge those 10 years between then and now, do you think that the Soviet withdrawal, one way or another, created a kind of vacuum into which the Taliban have now moved?
Well, when the Soviets left, what they did do was leave behind an enormous amount of weaponry and ammunition, and that certainly fueled the war when the other groups, there were seven main Mujahideen groups, were all vying for power, and fighting broke out soon after the Mujahideen took power in Kabul. That was one of the main legacies left by the Russians, and since then there's been absolutely no shortage of weaponry in Afghanistan. A point that Wali Massoud makes about Pakistan, it's not just Pakistan, it's other neighbouring countries that have been used either for supplying weapons to one side or the other, or for weapons to come through those countries.
And so it does seem then that for those reasons and others too, that this kind of instability really is endemic, has been for well over a century now.
Well, Afghanistan's always been pretty unstable, and, you know, people say, ah, the Afghans love fighting and always have done so over the centuries. But I think one thing that does need to be pointed out about over the past 20 years, there was the 10 years of the Soviet occupation when it was mostly the countryside that was razed to the ground, when those million Afghans you spoke of earlier were killed. It was mostly in the countryside. And then after the Soviets left, the fighting moved to the cities. It was in the cities, and specifically Kabul, the fighting between the different groups, and the front line, I remember, was in 94, for instance, was across the middle of Kabul, and literally about half the city was flattened over the course of about 2 years.
There, we'll have to leave it. William Reeve in Kabul, many thanks. Russell Padmore is rather closer, in fact he's right here in the studio, and he has the business news, I hope, anyway, Russell.
France has decided to privatise its aerospace and defence company, Aerospatiale. It's likely the move to sell the majority of the company will lead to a merger with another French firm, Matra, the defence subsidiary of Lagardère. It's the latest in a wave of expected acquisitions or mergers in the industry. Recently, British Aerospace bought Marconi from GEC, beating a rival French bidder, Thomson CSF. That buyout was completed despite BAE's talks with the German defence manufacturer Dassault, which is owned by Daimler Chrysler. The merger of Aerospatiale and Matra will create a defence company with annual sales of nearly $14 billion. An analyst with the Paris-based broker Chevreux de Viria, Remy Thomas, believes it's good news for Europe's aerospace industry.
Lagardère, as expected, will bring all its high-tech business, which includes the aerospace, the missile, the satellites, and the telecommunication equipment activities to Aerospatiale in exchange for a 33% stake in the new group. At this stage, the French government will hold a 44% stake in Matra Aerospatiale. Lagardère should have 33%, and the rest will be free float. I think it's very encouraging for the European industry as a whole. However, Thomson CSF doesn't have many options now that Marconi is about to merge with British Aerospace.
That's Remy Thomas, an analyst with Chevreux de Viria in Paris. Thousands of workers at Samsung Motors in South Korea will return to work later this week, ending a strike that has lasted 70 days. Nearly 4,000 assembly line workers voted in favor of accepting a deal between the company and trade unions that will guarantee jobs after a merger with Daewoo Motors. And as reported, the Swedish vehicle manufacturer Volvo is talking with the U.S. truck manufacturer Navistar about the possibility of taking the company over.
The latest from the financial markets now, London's 100 share index is currently 35.2 higher at 5,985.9. Earlier, Tokyo's Nikkei index closed higher at 14,054. No trading in the United States today, a national holiday. On the currency markets, the US dollar is worth 115 Japanese yen, the euro valued $1.12.4, and the pound is trading at $1.63.
Many thanks, Russell Padmore. If you'd like to tell us what you think about any of the issues covered in NewsHour, whether you agree or disagree with any of the opinions expressed in the programme, we'd be very pleased to hear from you. You can send your comments to NewsHour, BBC World Service, Bush House, London. Or you can send us an email. The email address is newshour@bbc.co.uk. One more time, newshour@bbc.co.uk. And we look forward to hearing from you. Coming up now in the programme, the Nigerian presidential election race begins to take shape, and fresh efforts to stamp out international business corruption will governments now need to crack the whip harder still. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Oliver Scott. You're tuned to NewsHour. And a summary now of world news, here's Guy Francis.
The largest political party in Nigeria, the People's Democratic Party, has declared its candidate for this month's presidential elections, the event marking the end of military rule. He's Olusegun Obasanjo, a former military head of state who's now favourite to lead the country on its return to democratic government. American diplomats in Turkey say that United States aircraft have carried out new attacks on Iraqi air defence installations in northern Iraq. The raids coincided with a visit to Ankara by the Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister, who's pressing Turkey to reduce its cooperation with the US. The Russian Foreign Minister has met the Serbian and ethnic Albanian delegations at the Kosovo peace talks in France as pressure grows on the warring parties to narrow their differences. He said there had to be a political solution to the conflict. A British judge and jury are travelling in Belarus today to visit the town of Domachevo, where thousands of Jews were killed during the Second World War. There, the British court will hear evidence in the case of Antony Savonyuk, who is charged with killing four Jews during the German occupation. He denies the charges. Ceremonies are being held throughout the former Soviet republics on the 10th anniversary of the withdrawal of the last Soviet troops from Afghanistan. There's been no official commemoration in Afghanistan. An Australian court has ordered the extradition of one of Italy's most wanted fugitives. The man, Giovanni Farina, is wanted in Italy on charges including kidnapping and attempted murder. And a group of 10 adventurers have set sail from Chile on a craft built of reeds in an attempt to cross the Pacific Ocean. The captain of the vessel said he wanted to prove that ancient peoples had the ability to travel across the oceans of the world centuries before the first Europeans arrived in the Americas. BBC World Service.
A veteran political heavyweight is beginning to make his presence felt in the Nigerian presidential election race. The former military ruler Olusegun Obasanjo has easily won his party's nomination for the job, and that party, the PDP, is in turn the most prominent in the country. The People's Democratic Party, to give it its full name, has already tested its political strength by winning important victories in local government and state elections since December. We're going now to Lagos to join the BBC's Barnaby Phillips. Barney, this looks like a pretty comprehensive victory on General Obasanjo's part.
Very comprehensive, Oliver, and I think it's actually taken a lot of people by surprise. He got well over 60% of the votes of the 2,400 or so delegates. The person who we all thought was running neck and neck with him, Dr. Alex Ekwueme, a former civilian vice president, ended up really with just over 20% of the votes. So I think it's fair to call it a crushing victory, and perhaps most significantly, the initial signs that the other six aspirants were going to accept in good grace. Dr. Ekwueme said that the voting in the convention had been fair.
Now, that, of course, is just the PDP voting. Who else is Mr. Obasanjo going to face in the race?
Bizarrely, we don't quite know yet, although today is the deadline for the submission of presidential candidates to the Electoral Commission. There are three parties in Nigeria. The second party, the All People's Party, has selected a candidate, a relatively unknown politician from the east of the country called Mr. Obonyaya Onu. He was rather foisted onto the APP at a convention in another northern town, Kaduna, this morning. Now, the APP is presently rushing down to Abuja to meet representatives of the third party, the Alliance for Democracy, AD, which has its own candidate, and they're going to talk in an awful hurry, one can only presume, about the possibility of forming some sort of alliance, putting up a single candidate who would take on the might of General Obasanjo and the PDP.
You speak of the might of General Obasanjo. What is his background, apart from having been military ruler back in, what, the late 70s?
Well, he first came to prominence in Nigeria during the Biafran War, the terrible civil war of the late 1960s, which almost tore this country apart. He played a prominent role on the federal side, fighting the Biafran rebellion. Of course, he's been more recently in the headlines. During the 1990s, he was actually imprisoned for 3 years by Nigeria's previous military ruler, General Sani Abacha, who accused him of having been involved in a coup plot. It's a charge he vehemently denies. It's something which his supporters say gives him that extra sort of moral legitimacy. They're almost fond of portraying him as the Nelson Mandela of Nigeria, somebody who has suffered for his convictions.
Barnaby Phillips in Lagos, many thanks. The various political parties have been setting out plans, more or less vague, on how they intend to improve living standards, which have generally fallen in 15 years of military rule in Nigeria. But political ideology is not necessarily that important. Ethnic allegiances and corruption often count for more. The transitional process to civilian rule also has its critics, who say that the entire process is in the hands of the military. Gaye Fawahinmi is leader of the Joint Action Committee, a relatively small party which opposes the transition process. First, what does he make of General Obasanjo's poll victory?
Well, we have to look at this from the background of the crisis in our country. Really, Obasanjo is a product of a lopsided political structure which we want rectified in our country. Since Obasanjo is specially chosen by a group who wanted him to help them in government to cover the track of the iniquities and atrocities they have committed while in government, particularly the generals, this is not good for the country.
But the point about this exercise surely is precisely that it will demilitarize the country, that General Obasanjo, were he to win the presidential election, would become a civilian head of state.
Well, he will become a civilian head of state within an atmosphere of highly disturbed polity. Obasanjo has said that he was not prepared to look at the past, and whoever might have stolen in the past, let it be. But the Nigerian people are saying no, that we'd like to visit the past so that we can make a positive future for Nigerians.
Nobody's denying, though, that major structural changes are needed, and also, of course, the collapse or the sharp fall in the oil price does absolutely nothing to help. But surely the whole point about a transition to democracy is that these very serious issues can now be tackled.
Well, first of all, this is the first time in our history that we shall be transiting to democracy without a constitution. I mean, nobody knows the framework, the constitutional framework that we are going to adopt. The election was held into the local governments on the 5th of December 1998 without the local government councillors and chairmen knowing their full powers, their functions and duties. Then we had another election on the 9th of January in spite of the State Assembly and also the gubernatorial election. And there are no constitutional framework provisions to spell out the powers and duties of the second tier of government. Now we are approaching the National Assembly election and the presidential election, and yet there is no constitution that has established this framework. What are we going to do? What are the powers of the state? What are the powers of the cabinet? What are the powers of ministers? And so on and so forth. We don't have that.
And that was Gaye Fawahinmi, leader of the Joint Action Committee in Nigeria.
10 years of work at the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, bears fruit today. An international agreement which it devised, outlawing bribery by companies in industrialized countries to win overseas contracts, comes into force. It's been hailed by the OECD Deputy Secretary General, Joanna Shelton, as a major step forward. But, as she frankly acknowledged, whether the agreement works or not depends on how effectively it's enforced. Carol Moen is from Transparency International, an independent anti-corruption organisation. He joins me on the line now. First of all, Mr. Moen, how many countries so far have signed up to this OECD agreement?
There are a total of 34 countries which have signed the convention, and as of today, 12 of these countries have actually ratified the convention, which means that they have passed national legislation implementing the convention.
So I'm not sure whether that constitutes slow progress or not. Are you pleased with developments so far?
Well, the timetable for this convention has been extremely ambitious. Actually, I would say there are very few conventions which have been passed in such a short span of time. So we are very optimistic that in the course of this year, many more countries will have ratified the convention. And actually, the countries which have ratified as of today constitute more than 50% of world trade. So this really is a major achievement.
A major step forward, as Joanna Shelton was saying. But there are one or two features which strike outsiders, at any rate, as a bit odd. For example, it only seems to hit people who are paying bribes, not people who are receiving them.
Yes, but I mean, one needs to be aware of the fact that a large share of the responsibility for corruption and bribery lies with the exporting countries from the industrialized north. And what they can do, they have done with that convention by criminalizing the export of bribery. Of course, this needs to be supplemented by work on the receiving end. And our more than 60 chapters around the world are very actively lobbying their governments and their private sector to do what they need to do to strengthen their country's national integrity systems.
So that's one step which you obviously consider important. What else would you say is needed, if not to make it watertight? That's probably a bit much to ask, but to make it tighter than it is now.
Well, the OECD countries and the other countries which have signed the convention, they need to agree on a strict and effective monitoring mechanism to make sure that it's not only words, but there's also follow-up action. And secondly, what is perhaps even more important is that business also look at their own corporate practice. I mean, it's fine to have a convention on paper, but as long as business will go on bribing, as they have done in many countries, nothing will change. And this convention really is a historic opportunity for business to say, okay, we now have a new legal framework, now it's upon us to change our practice. And this means that inside companies, there needs to be a reorganization of responsibilities. Very often today, the executives of corporations, of companies say, look, we want to have this contract, we don't want to know how you get it, and if you get it, you get a promotion. And this should be a practice of the past.
Carol Moen from Transparency International, many thanks. It's 5 months now since the Basque separatist organization ETA called an indefinite ceasefire. It's the first time the armed group has halted attacks for an unlimited period in its 30-year struggle for independence for the Basque region of northern Spain and southwestern France. The ceasefire has been warmly welcomed throughout Spain, and nowhere more so than in the Basque region itself. But, as Joan Episcopo reports, there's considerable caution nonetheless over just how to consolidate this first real chance of peace.
The headquarters of Spain's centre-right popular party in the Basque city of Vitoria. Local members have gathered to hear one of their leaders, visiting from Madrid for the day, outline the party's plans for elections due later this year. Not so long ago, it would have been hard to envisage such a convivial atmosphere here in the Basque Country. These local councillors, whose membership of a party ideologically opposed to nationalist demands for independence, were ETA's main targets. Six party members were killed by the armed group in the year preceding the ceasefire. Others received death threats, and all, like 31-year-old Antonio Palacios, had to have round-the-clock protection.
Pues ha cambiado mucho porque nosotros hemos vivido durante un año.
For a whole year we had to have a bodyguard 24 hours a day. That affects you. It affects your relationship with your wife, your family and your friends. People feel uncomfortable being with you.
But now the bodyguards are gone and there's guarded optimism here about the prospect of peace. These early steps towards peace owe much to a public who, over the last 18 months, have taken to the streets en masse to call for an end to three decades of Etta's violence. And in addition, events in Northern Ireland have been highly influential. As the peace process gained momentum there, it raised expectations amongst nationalists that a political outcome to the Basque conflict was also possible. But many are still cautious about how a peace process can evolve. Carlos Itogaiz is the president of the Popular Party in the Basque region.
What's happening at this moment? That ETA has said that they are stopping the guns, they are stopping the bombs, but they want to have some political benefits. We are worried for that position, and I think that it's very dangerous.
But although the ceasefire has held, there's been little progress so far in developing a political solution. There have been no talks, and a peace process as such has not yet begun. Moderate nationalists say for that to happen, several obstacles have yet to be overcome. Families of the 540 ETA prisoners held in jails all over Spain take part in a protest to demand that they're transferred to the Basque country to serve out their sentences. This is currently one of the most emotive issues in the Basque conflict and one of the main stumbling blocks. José María Echeverría of the PNV, the moderate governing Basque Nationalist Party, believes a move by Madrid towards resolving this could be the key to kick-starting a peace process.
I think one of the main important things Madrid has to do is, as we have always been saying, is to approach Basque prisoners to Basque country. I think it's not a political issue, it's a humanistic issue. And I think in order to get to know to people that there is political will in Madrid, they have to make a gesture in order to put the prisoners near Basque country.
But despite the seeming impasse amongst the politicians, Juan Gutierrez of the Peace Foundation Guernica Gogoratuz says people are optimistic that the tide has now changed.
There are always obstacles in peace processes and many moments where people despair. They think peace is out of reach, but then it comes through. And we'll have it. The one basic thing is that ETA won't come back. Everyone knows it here, the Spanish government too. ETA won't come back because ETA has made the ceasefire and got for it a united Basque nationalism, and it's the best form of unity they could have.
It's unclear what will happen next. Madrid's governing Popular Party will have to tread carefully round an electorate that outside the Basque country is hostile to any moves that will be seen as compromising Spain's nationhood. The challenge for the Basque nationalists is to ensure the ceasefire holds and that a peace process does evolve. On one thing, though, there is consensus. No one, it seems, wants to see a return to the violence of the last three decades.
Joanne Episcopo reporting there. And still to come before we close the programme, sport, of course, and why homeopathy is all the rage in India. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Oliver Scott, and this is NewsHour. And a recap on the main point in the news. The largest political party in Nigeria, the People's Democratic Party, has declared its candidate for this month's presidential elections, the event marking the end of military rule. He's Olusegun Obasanjo, a former military head of state. And we move on now to the sport, as promised, and we're joined by Russell Fuller. Russell, hi.
Hello, and we'll start with cricket, because the chief executive of the Pakistan board says India and Pakistan will play a test series every 2 years. Majid Khan was speaking a week after the first series between the two countries in almost a decade ended in a one-all draw.
From both sides, the Indian and Pakistan side, the players are looking forward
to having a regular series, and in both the boards we have agreed that we will play regularly. India will be coming to Pakistan in January, February, March of 2001. And from then onwards, we hope to have a full series rather than three test match series. It'll be five test match series, and it'll be played every 2 years.
And India and Pakistan meet again in Calcutta tomorrow as Test cricket's first multi-nation tournament gets underway. Some 90,000 fans are expected at Eden Gardens to watch the match. Well, Sri Lanka are the third team in the competition and may have an added financial incentive. The Sri Lankan board have announced that while some players could have their salaries reduced, others will be rewarded for good performances in the future. Sri Lanka failed to reach the finals of the recent one-day tournament in Australia and were also involved in a series of controversies. But the board's chief executive, Dharmika Ranatunga, says the new structure has been under consideration for some time and doesn't reflect on his side's recent performances.
We have been thinking about restructuring the player payments for a period of time. We are going to give a higher emphasis on the performances, but it is not due to Australian tour performances or the performances we had in the past. If you recall, we had a good series in England not far back, but even during that stage we were looking at giving more emphasis to performances.
In football, the former England international Kevin Keegan is expected to meet FA officials later today to discuss the vacant job of national coach. Since Glenn Hoddle's departure almost 2 weeks ago, Keegan has been the favourite to take over, but has always denied any interest in the job. Keegan is contracted to Second Division Fulham until the end of next season, but his chairman, Mohammed Al-Fayed, who owns Harrods, seems prepared to negotiate. Steve Double is a spokesman for the English Football Association.
Last night, Mohammed Al-Fayed confirmed that he's happy for the FA to talk to Kevin Keegan, and that probably ensures that today there'll be many more reporters than shoppers at Harrods, I suspect.
And Kevin Keegan and an FA representative will be there too, will they?
Well, we're not saying when or where, but what I must stress is that we're pursuing a number of options, and we hope to be in a position to have a positive announcement later on in the week.
Steve Double of the English Football Association rounding off the sport.
And the sport with Russell Fuller, and many thanks. Many are the alternative forms of medicine practiced in India, but it's a European system, homeopathy, which is expanding most rapidly. India is said to have more users and practitioners of homeopathy and to produce more homeopathic remedies than any other country. Andrew Whitehead reports.
Buying medicines over the counter at Bhandari's, one of Delhi's best-known homeopathic stores. The shelves are lined with ointments, tinctures, and thousands of tiny files of homeopathic pills. Sandeep Bhandari gave me a guided tour of the pharmacy.
That's a hair oil up there, and it's got some granules for children, like for babies, infants. And then we have some ear medicines, something for the heart, flu, hair falling, slimming, tonsils, etc.
But what are they made from?
Basically from herbs. Plants, herbs, sometimes insects also. And then we make tinctures and subsequently we raise the potencies to make dilutions.
But why is it that homeopathy, which in many countries is quite a small medical tradition, in India is so popular?
I think in India it's popular because A, it's cheap, B, it's got little side effects, and C, I think Indians by nature accept everything very easily. You know, West, they want to reason out everything. If it's, why is it working? So they scoff on homeopathy as such. And here people are, you know, more worried about the results, and the results are very positive. There must be about 100 factories also in India doing this business, manufacturing homeopathic medicines. It is the world leader in homeopathic medicine now.
I'm now standing outside Bhandari's homeopathic store, where there's a signboard listing all the ailments which homeopathy says it can treat, and it ranges from alcoholism through air sickness, dandruff, family planning even, stage fright, worms, dozens of ailments, most of which you wouldn't even begin to consider treating with conventional medicine. Of course, the big question is, does it work?
It does work.
You're quite sure it works, it's not simply that it's coincidence.
No, it's not that, because I've tried many times and I've been using for 40 years now.
They're good.
I would always prefer to use a homeopathic medicine before I go in for allopathy.
Why do you think homeopathy is so popular in India?
Cost factor. I would personally feel cost factor.
You're buying a couple of medicines.
I'm just buying one. I'm shocked. I bought 100 rupees, thinking that, you know, it's going to be expensive. And it just turned out to be 4 rupees.
4 rupees. Now, I'm just trying to work out what that is in terms of... that's about 10 American cents.
Too cheap.
Homeopathy is certainly much cheaper than conventional medicine. And in India, it's so popular that some imagine it originated here. In fact, homeopathy was pioneered by a German physician a little under 200 years ago. Many medical experts in the West dismiss homeopathy as quackery. In India, the various medical traditions hold each other in higher regard. It's not unusual for a conventional doctor to advise homeopathic treatment and vice versa. Indeed, India's best-known heart surgeon, Naresh Trehan, whose high-tech medical approach might seem to contradict all that homeopathy stands for, insists there is much to gain from closer collaboration between different schools of medicine.
I personally believe homeopathy has a lot to offer. The only thing that is missing in the alternate forms of medicine is that there is lack of diagnostics, accurate diagnostics, and lack of documentation. You cannot have widespread acceptance of a form of medicine if you don't know how reproducible your results are. If we took the diagnostic ability of modern medicine, which is absolutely tremendous, and then classified the problems a person is having, we could triage them to the appropriate form of medicine, because things like arthritis, like gastrointestinal problems, liver problems, modern medicine has very little to offer in them. Whereas homeopathy, Ayurveda, and Chinese form of medicine claim that they have very high success rate in that, those forms, but they have not been documented.
The main problem facing homeopathy in India is that there's no one organization regulating the profession, organizing medical trials, and authorizing treatments. But it does have official recognition. And here, at least, homeopathic doctors have gained what has so far eluded them in many other parts of the world, the respect of the medical establishment.
And that report from Andrew Whitehead. Leaders of the Roman Catholic Church from across the Americas are discussing the role of the Church in the next millennium. They're doing it, moreover, in Cuba. To hold the twice-yearly Inter-American Bishops meeting in Havana would have been quite unthinkable before Pope John Paul's visit to Cuba last year. On the line now from Havana is Pascal Fletcher. Pascal, the Pope seems to have softened up opinion, as it were, in Havana. What's in it for the Cuban government, would you say?
Well, basically, the fact that the Cuban government is allowing the meeting to be held here is a sign of very much of the improved relations between the government and the church. There's been a brief mention of the meeting in the state media, but very brief. I don't think your average Cuban necessarily even knows that it's happening. But it is a sign of the improved relations, and one of the things the meeting will be doing is looking at the impact of the Pope's visit last year to Cuba and seeing what impact it's really had on the life of the church on the island.
What about Mr. Castro? Is he taking a neutral view, or will he be going along? Will he be socializing with the bishops?
I'm not sure he'll be appearing during the actual discussions. The line the church has been taking is that there's no formal meeting scheduled, but of course they can't rule out, they say they can't rule out a meeting, and I'd be very surprised if he didn't at some point receive the bishops.
Is Cuba a Catholic country overwhelmingly?
Well, it has a history of Catholicism culturally and historically. It's been a Catholic country, but obviously we've had 30 years of revolution and Marxist ideology, and that certainly weakened the impact of Catholicism on the country. We hear that since the improvement of relations and the Pope's visit, there's been a revival of faith, but I think it's going to be quite a long process, and the Church has certainly got its work cut out, if you like, to try and instill religion in the country.
I've no doubt it has. Do the bishops, though, do you think, imagine they're taking a small step in that direction, reasserting the authority of the Church, if you like, by the simple fact of holding their meeting there?
Oh, yes, I mean, it's clear, and they've made this clear, that the fact that they're holding the meeting in Cuba is intended as a sign of support for the local Cuban church in its efforts to widen and strengthen its pastoral role in Cuban society. There's been some concessions, like the authorization of a Christmas Day holiday and some more visas for foreign priests and religious to work in Cuba, but there's still a lot of demands that the church is still making. For example, access to the state media, guaranteed access to the state media, and participation in education and social services, which remain a monopoly of the state.
And literally, in one sentence, Pascal, do the bishops feel they can speak their mind?
I think they'll certainly be speaking their mind. This is a closed-door meeting, but yes, I think so.
Pascal Fletcher in Havana, many thanks for joining us. And Pascal brings us to the end of this edition of the programme. As always, thanks for being with us. And as always, too, we will be back at the same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, though, from all of us here in the studio, bye for now.